This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. Afghan's military chief says Taliban insurgents attacked and overran a key army base in southeastern Afghanistan on Saturday, capturing dozens of soldiers and killing several others. The latest attack comes the same day the U.S. and NATO partners are beginning to formally withdraw their militaries from the country after almost 20 years of war. Afghan lawmakers tell VOA the Afghan army had stationed dozens of its forces at the base before the pre-dawn attack. Local media reports say clashes lasted several hours and killed at least 17 soldiers. A separate suicide bombing Friday in eastern Afghanistan killed at least 30 and injured more than 100 others, almost all civilians. Critics fear violence will only get worse as there is no peace agreement between the Taliban and the Afghan government, and foreign troops will be gone by September 11th. India's coronavirus nightmare continues as thousands are losing their lives every day, and not just from COVID-19. 18 patients died Saturday in a fire at a hospital near Mumbai. Another 8 died Saturday from an oxygen shortage at a hospital in the capital, New Delhi. Doctors there had declared a state of emergency, warning government officials they were going to lose patients. An oxygen tanker arrived over an hour after supply ran dry, far too late. That's on top of a record 3,500 COVID deaths recorded Saturday, the same day India became the first country to top 400,000 new infections in one day. The country is stepping up its vaccination drive, saying all adults over 18 can get their shots. However, some states say they don't have any vaccines to give. Find more on the story at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Explosions could be heard throughout Myanmar's largest city, Yangon, on Saturday as protesters held marches for democracy, defying the brutal junta that has held on to power for 3 months now. The country has been in an uproar since the military ousted civilian leader Aung San Suu Kyi on February 1st. The power grab led to a massive uprising, which authorities have tried to stop by using lethal force. Myanmar enters its fourth month under military rule on Saturday. Nearly 760 civilians have been killed in the anti-coup unrest, according to a local monitoring group, though the junta has recorded a far lower death toll. Russia's delegation says talks on Iran's nuclear agreement are making steady progress and will continue next week after a third round of negotiations on Saturday in Vienna, aimed at bringing the United States back into the accord. The deal, which curbs Iran's nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief, has been on life support since then U.S. President Donald Trump bolted in 2018. The remaining partners have been engaged in negotiations since early April to try to revive it. After almost a month of talks, the parties this week expressed a desire to speed up the negotiations. The U.S. holds its most famous annual horse race on Saturday, the 147th running of the Kentucky Derby at America's iconic Churchill Downs. The so-called most exciting 2 minutes in sports will see the return of spectators months after last year's delayed Derby had no crowd because of the pandemic. A central quality is the favored horse, owned by a Dubai ruler facing human rights protests. Activists wanted the race canceled, and there have also been other protests over police gun violence in the city of Louisville, the site of the Kentucky Derby. The U.S. government is extending the requirement that travelers wear face masks on planes, trains, and buses. The rule was set to expire May 11th, but the Transportation Security Administration said Friday it will extend the requirement through September 13th. Children under 2 and people with certain disabilities are exempted. Meanwhile, aviation officials say the U.S. will continue its zero-tolerance policy against disruptive airline passengers as long as the mask rule is in effect. That policy has led to large fines against some passengers who argue with airline crews. Airlines and their unions had pushed for an extension of the mask rule. Find more on the story and the rest of the day's news at voanews.com, and always follow Voice of America on the VOA mobile app. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
When you have supported them publicly, to deny that support and also to make it feel as if that he was remorseful of the things he had done. No, he was outed now and he's coming out to say this all for him to say things. The president needs to start campaigning, and that's it.
A Nigerian cleric demands the impeachment of President Muhammadu Buhari.
AU needs to be fair and do things in the right way when it comes to Chad.
The African Union deploys a fact-finding mission to Chad.
How are political parties obtain their funding? They can basically obtain their funding from any source. And so we feel that that is something that is a danger even to our democracy and to the electoral process in its entirety. Because then you can easily have illicit money finding its way in political parties.
And Transparency International expresses concern about cash distribution to potential voters by politicians ahead of the Zambian August 12 elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian cleric is coming under criticism for calling for the impeachment of President Muhammadu Buhari. Reverend Ejike Mbaka, head of the Adoration Ministry, says the president should be impeached if he doesn't resign over what he says is the president's failure to resolve the deteriorating security situation in the West African country. But his call has drawn a sharp rebuke from Yekini Nabena, deputy spokesperson for the Governing All Progressive Congress, or APC. He warns that the pastor's call threatens the country's security and territorial integrity. Nabena calls on the pastor his comment unfortunate and irresponsible. The pastor's views, however, are generating support from civil society and opposition groups. They express concern that the security situation is getting worse, with reports of daily kidnappings, murder, and violence carried out by Boko Haram and other militant Islamic groups. Aisha Yusufu is a Nigerian socio-political activist and convener of the Bring Back Our Girls movement. She tells me that calls for the president to resign or be impeached is legitimate due to what she says is the worsening violence in Nigeria.
I align with the people who are asking for his resignation. And when he doesn't resign, the National Assembly should impeach the president. The life of Nigeria is much more important than the ambition of the president. And for him, his, the fact that he's getting the sack of office isn't what we are going through as a nation, where people are being killed with impunity, where the nation isn't being secured, where terrorists are taking over territories in Nigeria and also hoisting their flags, as you have heard from the governor of Niger State. And I think at this moment, the territorial integrity of Nigeria should be much more important than the ambition of the president. The security of lives and properties of Nigerians should be much more important than the ambition of the president. And he has repeatedly shown that he doesn't have the capacity to be able to lead Nigeria and keep Nigeria safe and secure, and he needs to go.
Garba Shehu defended him by saying that it's not as if killings have not happened before. It's not like Boko Haram has not attacked people before, but then the government has stepped up efforts to protect life and property in Nigeria, and that nobody can bring President Buhari's government down. How do you respond to his defense?
Nobody can bring the President Buhari's government down. I agree with the spokesperson of the president, because the government of President Muhammadu Buhari is already down. It is down, and there's no way anybody can bring it down. The president himself and his spokespeople and his appointees have already brought the government down. What we are working on is getting the government of Nigeria up. And when they come with this harebrained idea that terrorism needs to happen before, why did they come on the mantra of change? Was it not a change of the Terrorist Act to stop? Now we have insecurity has worsened, and it's in every part of the nation. There are some roads that people dare not to travel upon. People are being kidnapped left, right, and center. It's almost like an enterprise in Nigeria to be kidnapped. That wasn't what Nigerians voted for.
Some people are suggesting that it will be difficult for the House of Reps and the Senate to impeach the president due to what they say is close relations with senior party officials in both chambers. But do you see that happening?
The National Assembly has repeatedly shown that there are people that do not have the capacity to do the right thing for Nigeria. They have repeatedly shown that they do not have the guts to do the needful for the nation. And all they care about is their political ambition. And that's one of the reasons why I have repeatedly said to Nigeria, why do you call senators distinguished when they have not distinguished themselves? Why do you call House of Reps members honorable when they have behaved dishonorably most times? And so we must understand that the people that we have there are people who really do not have their loyalty to Nigeria, but to political leaders. They are political leaders who brought them, or the power brokers. And I think this should be a lesson to all Nigerians, in the sense that we must be mindful of the people that we put in the National Assembly. It's very, very critical. Right now, what is the incentive that they have for them to do the right thing? Is it that they know they are going to be recalled? Is it that they know that Nigerians are not going to vote for them again because they didn't do the needful for Nigeria? We must ensure that we begin to punish bad behavior. And politicians who do not put Nigeria first, Nigeria should really punish them when it comes to the election day at the polling unit.
On another development, the government has come out to strongly support Communication and Digital Economy Minister, Mr. Issa Pantami. He also says that he will not resign by agents who have been paid to undermine his integrity and to tarnish his hard-earned reputation. How do you respond to that?
He needs to resign. Not just to resign, the president needs to fire him. We cannot have a terrorist sympathizer as Minister of Communication. I have a 19-year-old daughter who is going to be 20 in December. I have a 22-year-old son. I cannot put their information in the hands of somebody who was sympathizing with terrorists. And I think Issa Pantami needs to understand that if he is an agent, not everyone is an agent, and Nigeria is bigger than his ambition, and he really should be ashamed of himself to the extent of which he's going to. One of the things that we've had a lot of argument that is being said is the fact that, Pantami has come out to regret his earlier stance and that he has dissociated himself from the sympathies he had for terrorists. And I need to ask the question, where did he dissociate himself? Because even when all of this story started breaking up, Pantami was in denial. He was making mouth and saying that he was going to go to court. All of these things were like until irrefutable proof were brought out and evidence. Verifiable evidence they put out there. And that's when he came out to say, oh no, he didn't have those ideologies anymore. He wasn't. Of course, what do we expect somebody who has been planted in place to say? He was outed, and this is what he said. There's never a place where he came out publicly, the way he had supported them publicly, to deny that support and also to make it feel as if that, he was remorseful of the things he had done. No, he was outed now and he's coming out to say this, all for him to say things. The president
needs
to start
campaigning,
and that's it.
Aisha Yusufu is a Nigerian socio-political activist and co-convener of the Bring Back Our Girls movement. She spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The African Union has deployed a fact-finding mission to Chad to assess the situation there. The team, which is on a 7-day assignment, is tasked with finding ways to quickly return the West African country to constitutional rule. The delegation is expected to meet leaders of the military council, civil society and opposition political parties. The visit comes as members of the opposition demand the military council respect the constitution. This after the military took over power following the death of former President Idris Deby. His son has since been named to head the council to lead the country until elections are held in 18 months. But opposition groups condemn the move as a coup and are calling on the international community to pressure the military to hand over power to civilian leaders. They are also calling for the suspension of Chad's membership in both the Economic Community of West African State, or ECOWAS, and the African Union. They argue that both organizations have a policy of zero tolerance for the overthrow of a constitutionally elected government. For more reaction about the AU fact-finding mission to Chad, I reached Delphine Kemnilom Jiraibe, a lawyer and human rights and civil rights defender in the Chadian capital, N'Djamena.
People think that the African Union should condemn right away the coup d'etat and not recognize the CMT. Now that they decide to send the fact-finding mission, we hope that it is not a way to push things back and that they will issue very quick the resolutions to help the situation go back to normal. And going back to normal is going back to what the Constitution said. So no transition led by Mr. Deby's son and by militaries.
You are calling it a coup d'etat, but some people are saying it is not necessarily a coup d'etat and that they are trying to stabilize Chad, to usher Chad into democracy by organizing elections within the next 18 months. Why are people not pleased about this?
If it is not a coup d'etat, then the constitution should prevail, because the militaries have acted exactly as they have done a coup, and they take power and they stay in power till now. So what you call that, if it is not a coup d'etat? It is really a coup d'etat. And what we are saying is that people are really fed up with the Deby's system that have old people under very, very, very dire situation for 13 years. People have no access to proper health care, to electricity, to water, to education. Everything is kind of down, and people are really tired. His son take over the power and continue. We are not in a dynasty. We are in a country. We want it to be democratic. So now people are taking their power and saying no more of that. Let's go for an all-inclusive dialogue that would set a government that everybody should agree upon, and that government should organize a free and credible elections.
So what are the expectations of Chadians about the presence of the African Union mission they call a fact-finding mission? What are their expectations?
The high expectation is that the African Union could put pressure on militaries to go back and abide by the constitution. We need really to have a civilian transition, and that's what is expected by everybody. No more of military governance, no more of continuation of what Mr. Idriss Deby have led Chad on.
Some opposition groups are calling for the suspension of Chad membership in the African Union, as well as the international community, until elections are held and civilian leaders elected. What is the situation on the ground, and how are civil society groups, including yours, reacting to these calls?
This is really what needs to be done, because this is a proper pressure to put on militaries to go back to abide by the constitution. And we are surprised that till now the AU did not take that position. Like, for example, like in Mali, the reaction was right away, and we wonder why in Chad it should be different. That's our position. We need a proper, strong position on the military groups to allow the proper transition led by civilians to be in place. We, civil society in Chad, strongly support the position of some AU countries that are asking for the suspension of Chad till the normal situation is in place, till the proper elections is organized. So that is really not what needs to be done. AU needs to be fair and do things in the right way when it comes to Chad.
Delphine Kemnulium Jiraibe is a lawyer, a human rights and civil rights defender. She spoke with me from the Chadian capital in N'Djamena. Sierra Leone celebrated its Independence Day on April 27. Several heads of state and government attended the ceremony in the capital, Freetown. But many Sierra Leoneans say the country should be better off than it is today, 60 years after gaining independence from Britain in 1961. Critics say the current administration under President Julius Maada Bio has yet to meet the aspirations of the people. They cite high youth unemployment and difficulty doing business as a couple of the challenges the president and his administration have yet to resolve. But supporters reject the accusations. They say the administration's free education policy and its fight to sharply reduce corruption are worthy of support. For example, they say the government is using revenue earned from the campaign against graft and mismanagement for state-sponsored programs, including improvements in agriculture that have created opportunities for the youth. For more on the Independence Day celebrations and the latest development, I reached Sierra Leonean Information Minister Mohamed Rahman Suare.
Commemorate this occasion, we had the privilege of playing host to four African leaders from Ghana, President Nana Akufo-Addo, President Adama Barrow from the Gambia. We had Professor Alpha Conde from Guinea. We had President George Manuel from Liberia. We had the Vice President, Professor Osibanjo of Federal Republic of Nigeria. And we had Prime Minister Obalo from Guinea-Bissau, amongst other delegations representing various leaders. So this was quite a potpourri of activities. And we feel very highly honored to have had this kind of attendance amidst a major global pandemic, which has been ravaging the whole world.
This year marks the third year following his election to the presidency. What do you think has been the success story? Because some people are saying he has failed to meet the aspirations of Sierra Leoneans for the last 3 years.
I mean, we expect the opposition to say anything and everything virtually. But the fact of the matter is that in the first 1 year of his presidency, President Julius Maada Bio was able to launch a very ambitious free quality education project, which currently caters for 2.5 million kids from pre-primary school to senior secondary school, with all expense paid, including the provision of core textbooks and, in some instances, school feeding programs. We have allocated 22% of our budget to education because the president is very clear. If you want to destroy a country, simply destroy its educational system. And that was done very diligently by the previous administration. Apart from education, we have a major policy shift in agriculture, ensuring, A, that tractors are now given to those who deserve it, to farmers. Farm inputs are now channeled through the private sector. That is not only going to create jobs and opportunities for young people, it's also going to contribute to ensuring food security for the country.
Next 2 years of the presidency before elections, what should the people of Sierra Leone expect from this government?
Like I mentioned, we have a major policy shift in agriculture. We expect a bumper harvest in the next years so that we are able to reduce the importation of rice. Many Sierra Leoneans should be able to have food on their tables. There is also the policy that all government appointees should invest in agriculture. I have a big farm, right? So I now grow what I eat and eat what I grow. It's the same for many members of cabinet. This is a leadership example that has been set by His Excellency the President. So the rest of us are emulating his example. Apart from that, Peter, you know, we have also ensured that we have pressed the reset button to ensure that for the very first time in the history of our country, Sierra Leoneans are able to benefit from their God-given natural resources. Under the leadership of His Excellency President Bio, we have commissioned an airborne geophysical survey, and by that survey, we now have accurate scientific data, razor-edge precision, so that investors can readily be given the much-needed information they require rather than align them to explore for years on end. This is going to put Sierra Leone in the driving seat in the management of our natural resources.
What are some of the measures the government is putting in place to reduce the what some people describe as the high unemployment among the country's youth? Because they say that the situation has become rather difficult and that there are too many youth out there who have been unable to find jobs.
Yes, we have our fair share of unemployment, but a lot of efforts are being made by government to ensure that we ameliorate the situation. For example, youth farms are now being developed in all the 149 chiefdoms across the country. I have been on a tour in the last few days before we got into the independence commemoration mood. Those youth in those communities are grateful that they now have an opportunity to work on their own terms and eke out a living where possible, sell the surplus to potential buyers. So that is one area we are investing. Again, we have a predominantly youthful population. Many of them do not have the requisite skills that is required by the labor market. President Biya, being a visionary president, has allocated, together in support with support from the World Bank, has allocated $22 million to a skills development fund to capacitate young men, youth, young men and women with the requisite technical, vocational education and training to make them eligible for jobs in the labor market. Where they could not, they could also learn entrepreneurial skills, which could make them employable to potential employers, or can make them employers of, you know, their compatriots.
Mohamed Rahman Soare is the Sierra Leonean Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. The UN Refugee Agency reports nearly 30,000 people have fled from the oil and gas-rich coastal town of Palma and Cabo Delgado, Mozambique. It says many people remain trapped in this town, which came under armed attack late last month. It says those who are able to flee continue to do so by foot, road and sea. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Most of those who have fled Palma have gone to Pemba, the capital of northern Mozambique's Cabo Delgado province. The UN Refugee Agency says dozens of people reportedly have been killed by Islamist militants who began their assault on the oil and gas-rich town on March 24th. UN Refugee spokesman Baba Baluch says thousands of people fled Palma in a panic, by foot, by road, and by sea. He says they have been arriving in Pemba with no belongings, often in ill health or with injuries and severely malnourished. He says desperate people are still on the run.
They are fleeing still Palma area. As far as till last night, my colleagues in Pemba were telling me that there were three boats that arrived with civilians, at least 100 people on board. And as we were talking, majority of them are women and children.
Baluch says many more people are believed to be trapped inside Palma, unable to leave. France's energy giant Total recently suspended a multi-billion dollar gas project in northern Mozambique because of the jihadist assault. Baluch says government forces are on the ground inside Palma, but he does not know how much of the area they have secured. He says UNHCR aid workers are unable to work there because of the dangers. He says the ongoing armed conflict in Cabo Delgado has resulted in grave human rights abuses. He says critical services are disrupted, and that is seriously affecting civilians. Children, who account for half of the displaced population, are at particular risk. He says many children get separated from their families during their flight to Pemba.
Hundreds of children have arrived traumatized and exhausted after being separated from their families. Many others have come with their mothers. UNHCR is working with UNICEF and our other partners in referring vulnerable displaced children to appropriate services or for family reunification, mental health and psychological support, as well as material assistance.
Cabo Delgado's four-year-long conflict has killed or injured tens of thousands of people and forcibly displaced more than 700,000. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Zambia, Transparency International is expressing concern about cash distribution to potential voters by politicians ahead of the August 12 elections. The anti-graft group says the practice will undermine the integrity of the upcoming polls. This after incumbent Vice President Madam Inonge Wina was captured on video distributing cash to supporters at a recent campaign stop. Critics say the Vice President is using state resources to influence prospective voters before the presidential and legislative polls. They contend that the use of those resources to buy votes is a clear case of the failure of the government to meet the aspirations of the people. Opposition groups are calling on voters to reject the governing Patriotic Front during the elections, but supporters of the PF say the criticisms are overblown and aimed at scoring political points to drive down the popularity of the ruling party before the vote. They argue that it is commonplace for politicians to show appreciation to their supporters during the campaign period. Maurice Nyambi is the executive director of Transparency International in Zambia. He tells me that the use of money to influence voters ahead of the elections is unacceptable.
It is disturbing for a number of reasons. The first of which is that this has to be understood within the context of what has been happening. So what has been happening is that we have been seeing quite a number of leaders, largely from the Patriotic Front government. These are being ministers, as well as people that are hoping to be adopted to stand for different positions on the Patriotic Front ticket. We have been seeing them going around in communities, distributing huge, huge stacks of money to potential voters. So it is within that context that what the Vice President did on that video, I think, is something that really gives us a lot of concern. The issue is that money is being distributed at all. And I think that is something that we need to call out, and that is something that we have called out, and it's something that we should not see within the context of an electoral season such as the one that we are in as a country.
Do you see this as trying to influence the voters to vote for the PF, or by extension, as some people say, to buy votes for the party in the upcoming August general election?
Yes, indeed, Peter. And the context is that we are in an election season that is fraught, you know, with all sorts of accusations and all sorts of concerns and worries about the different motivations of the different political players for doing anything that they are doing. So it follows that anything that you do in this particular context, in such a heightened election season, is bound to be misunderstood in a particular direction by the different stakeholders that are at play within this particular particular context. And so it is very difficult for one not to reach the conclusion that what you know, members of the PF are doing, and indeed what the Vice President herself was engaged in, is not anything that is intended to, you know, to influence the electorate in a particular direction. It's very difficult not to reach that conclusion, because that appears to be the modus operandi that the PF appears to have adopted. And I think this is something that is very worrying, even for us as TI Zambia, because ultimately it actually undermines the integrity of our electoral process. And I don't think that it is something that should be tolerated by anybody.
Maurice, Sunday Chanda, the media director for Patriotic Front, has issued a directive before this that PF members should stop distributing money. However, some people are suggesting that this is a common occurrence in Zambian politics, where traditionally when you go to campaign, the people expect some monies to exchange hands as a tradition, and people are blowing this out of proportion. How do you respond to that?
Peter, I don't think that that is actually accurate to put it like that, as Mr. Sande Chanda has put it. What is indisputable is that, you know, in the Zambian tradition or in Zambian setup, whenever you go, for example, to a traditional leader, whenever you are visiting a traditional leader, the expectation is that you will go with some form of gift, which is, you know, some form of appreciation for for the fact that that traditional leader has given you audience. And this gift does not necessarily need to be in form of money. And indeed, it is not always in form of money. It can be things like maybe a bag of sugar or a bottle of cooking or things of that nature. So it is not correct to say that it is normal within Zambia's political dispensation.
Morris, some people have cited Hakainde Hichilema, the presidential candidate for the UPND, of doing something similar, of distributing monies to supporters at campaign stops. So some people are suggesting that if this is what is occurring, then there has to be a constitutional amendment banning the distribution of money during campaigns in order to ensure that the integrity of elections are protected in Zambia. What is your take?
One of the issues that we have raised, even within the context of our programming, is this whole aspect of the role of money in our electoral process. So, yes, it seems that it is something that is starting to happen in different contexts and to different extents. And that's why we have said that even issues of campaign financing for political parties, for example, are things that we need to get to the bottom of. Right now, Zambia does not have any form of legislation that regulates how political parties obtain their funding. They can basically obtain their funding from any source. And so we feel that that is something that is a danger even to our democracy and to the electoral process in its entirety. Because then you can easily have illicit money finding its way in political parties.
Maurice Nyambi is the Executive Director of Transparency International in Zambia. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The Center for Disease Control, or CDC, says vaccinated Americans no longer need to wear masks when outside. They should, however, wear masks when they are in large crowds. Some health experts say the latest guidelines ensure a slow but steady return to normalcy. Others say the CDC's new policy appears to be overly cautious. They argue that the latest announcement should have been made earlier. To discuss the new CDC guidelines and what they mean moving forward, including for international travel, I reached Dr. Richard Quigley, Senior Vice President and Global Medical Director of International SOS Assistance and MedAir.
I think it's long overdue, and I was very pleased to see the guideline, and I'm hoping that it's the beginning of a trend or a transition to a point where we will be able to finally get rid of the masks. But it's an excellent first step, and I'm aligned with it 100%. And I believe that the CDC has posted on their website today specific details of the different permutations and combinations of meeting outdoors and different profiles of people, i.e. people who may be immunocompromised or otherwise at high risk, and how one would behave in front of those with regards to wearing a mask, even if you've been vaccinated.
Well, Dr. Quigley, as Senior Vice President and Global Medical Director of International SOS, what will you say those traveling overseas, perhaps in Europe or particularly in Africa, do with regards to this new directive from the CDC?
Good question. And it's a question that I'm sure I'm going to start getting as soon as the calls are escalated to me. But I think the bottom line will be that it is imperative that whoever the international traveler might be or wherever they may be going, that they do their homework in advance of their trip and they find out what are the requirements with regards to mask wearing and, for that matter, any other precautions that may be taken related to COVID-19 mitigation in their destination. So, for example, if somebody's leaving America and they've been vaccinated, they may be going to a destination where testing is required before arrival, testing is required before you come back, and even in the extreme case, quarantine is required regardless of your vaccination status. So it would behoove anybody prior to travel to do their homework and determine what are the requirements at my destination site and be compliant with those in order to avoid any hang-ups as they cross borders.
So talk to me about what happens next after this latest guidelines from the CDC.
It's really up to the CDC, who are, generally speaking, as you, I'm sure, observed, quite risk-averse. They're doing their homework. They really want to find out definitively whether or not somebody who has been vaccinated can still get infected, even though there's a preponderance of evidence indicating they most likely will not be so. But that, and I think they're waiting for that data, which is coming from a variety of sources, including but not limited to the pharmaceutical companies that are mass producing these vaccines. And I think once we know the answer to that, another drop in the requirements or the mandates for masks and the circumstances under which we have to wear them.
Well, with this news, some people suggest that a semblance of normalcy has been returned. What is your take on that?
I don't know if I know what normalcy is anymore, and I don't know whether anybody does. I'm really of the mindset that since this pandemic, we've all been made very much aware of hygienic best practices, the importance of staying away from people when you have an illness, particularly one that's transmitted through the respiratory tree. And so I'm not sure that I can answer the question with certainty. What I do know is that we all want to get back to where we were pre-COVID, me included. But I think that the new world as we know it, even once we have reached herd immunity, which may be some time for a variety of reasons, will still include everybody's focus on hygienic best practices and awareness of hygienic best practices.
What would be your advice to people following this new guidelines from the CDC?
Follow the CDC guidelines. Know full well that the CDC is making their decisions based on a variety of different resources from around the world. They collaborate with organizations both in the private and the public sector, and they come out with their best effort at what best practices should be to prevent and mitigate against transmission of this deadly virus. So I think people, despite the fact many of them have what we call pandemic fatigue, need to remain patient and remain vigilant about what's going on and be educated about the reality of this disease because it's still here. Look at what's going on in India right now. It's a crisis beyond anybody's wildest imagination. So the disease is still with us, and it will be with us for some time.
Dr. Richard Quigley is Senior Vice President and Global Medical Director of International SOS Assistance, MMEDA. He spoke with me on his way to New York. The New Development Bank, the financial wing of the international economic bloc known as BRICS, has loaned South Africa $1 billion for job creation during the COVID-19 pandemic. BRICS is the acronym used to describe the five major emerging economies of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The South African government says it will use the money to fund hundreds of thousands of jobs in the public sector. But financial analysts and business organizations are warning against this approach. For VOA, Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
The state already employs 1.2 million public servants, many who work at largely dysfunctional municipalities that struggle to deliver basic services such as sanitation. The last financial year saw it shelling out more than $50 billion on wages for these people, almost a third of total government expenditure. Now, the administration of President Cyril Ramaphosa wants to use the BRICS loan to employ an additional 700,000 individuals.
The public service is already bloated, and to continue to increase the public service at a time when we have a fiscal crisis is a problem.
Cas Kuvadia is the chairman of Business Unity South Africa, or BUSA, an association representing many of the country's leading companies.
If we're going to borrow money, we've got to use that money in infrastructure and other areas that directly create the environment for investment and put us onto a growth path so that the growth path enables us to actually deal with our fiscal situation, and through growth we can actually manage the money we are borrowing. Otherwise, what we're doing is we're simply increasing our debt and not having any additional...
BUSA's view is that South Africa needs infrastructure, not more government jobs.
Things like putting money into the Durban port to fix it up, to sort it out, to make it more efficient and more competitive, to sort out our railroad system so that people don't have to spend so much time and so much money traveling from places of residence to work. That immediately has a direct economic income. And there are other areas.
These are the types of development that attract investment, argues Kuvadia, while a mass employment scheme to fuel an already inefficient public service does the opposite.
Businesses are ready to invest in this country if the environment for investment is created. South African businesses are investing in other parts of the country because the environment for investment is actually being created in other parts of the country. Global players are saying they want to invest here, but again, the environment for investment is not there.
Busa would like the government to pay more attention to its post-COVID economic recovery strategy document. It explains that a few essential markers need to be in place before the state can expect firms to plow billions of dollars into a struggling economy.
The government is saying that the ease of doing business has improved in the country. Well, then our ratings in the ease of doing business index should go up. They haven't gone up. Another marker is that our ratings in the world competitive index must go up. They haven't gone up yet.
But the government's adamant. It's using the BRICS loan to post thousands of people to its offices around the country. Economic analysts say it's an easy way to escape criticism at a time when the government's job creation efforts are under fire and unemployment is at a record high of almost 33%. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
There she is.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Sugar break. Benghazi on this one.
Yeah. You say you can never be the one, but God say, make I tell you, say now you him choose. In 1 month, in 1 week, you will sing a new song. In 2 days, unless of that, you will hear. Congratulations, you're in the glory of God. Congratulations, he has done it for you, and you will come back with a new song to sing. God is good.
Yes, that was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Bill Igor, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when you live next to the cemetery, you cannot weep for everyone. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.